Evening, Netminer.
Good evening.
Evening, Wee Band 5150. How's everyone doing tonight?
Oh, I gotta tell you guys, I haven't caught up with my sleep very good the last couple of nights. Sleep's starting to catch up on me.
Well, I'm doing better. Still recovering from my mother's thing.
I'm holding together all right.
And there's a new member in my CPU family.
A new member in your what?
The computer museum that I call Systems.
Oh yeah, what'd you get?
An old E-machine, Semipron, LE, 1250.
You have big plans for it?
Well, I have already used it to find out whether any of my more modern machines can support a new video card, and the answer seems to be no. The power supplies are marginal.
Yeah, I too added a machine this week unexpectedly. One of my two or three eBay, I didn't realize things got so cheap. It's a, I didn't know how big it was until it got here. 17 inch. It's an HP a few years old with a AMD M2 processor, and that's where they got into having, you know, its graphics and Radeon graphics accelerator on the same chip. So it's dual core Radeon, you know, now probably not what you'd want to pick for your gaming machine, but I don't really have any graphics accelerated laptops, so I got it. 500 gig hard drive, all in for $75.
That sounds like a good deal.
Yeah, and I saw some other stuff that I'll get to during the show that I think may be interesting along the same line.
One of the things that I'm, because this only has a VGA output, and somebody has screwed up the screw mounts for that, this new box will probably be serverized as soon as I get an OS installed. Going to be doing some serious work headless. I've always wanted to work on, you know, old school client server X and whatnot, but I've always built my machines to pretty much run as desktops for local administration and whatnot.
Have we had any feedback to speak of in the last couple of weeks?
Yes, I believe actually there was. Hold on.
On the mailing list, I don't see anything in between the last two sets of show notes.
I just posted it in the show notes. It's apparently from somebody named Vix, V-I-C-S.
Yeah, and Kay Wisher also posted a link in the Google Plus. I'm in the process of getting over in the show notes.
50 years. Any way you can get your volume up a little bit, whether it's just moving the mic a little bit or something, or just a little faint.
Okay, is that any different than moving the mic a little closer? As close as I can get.
No, that didn't help.
Yeah, I might drop out a moment and drop back in. The on this machine, it does this weird thing that menus don't want to work once I get started, so I can't get any configuration.
Which machine is that?
Oh, it's this old Toshiba laptop. Oh, I still haven't got the tower working again. That's one of the things I meant to do in the last couple of weeks and didn't do.
Is that any better? In Pulse Audio Audio Player, my mic game was way low.
Much better.
Holy hell! I thought the voice of God was coming through.
You want me to slide it back some?
Just a touch. But I think that's the best you've ever heard, and I've ever heard you in a long, long time.
Okay, it's probably been that setting. I don't know how it got that low. I guess you got to watch these things. Gremlins move the sliders around.
They do. I've seen them.
You know, it just occurred to me I didn't have to restart Mambo because the Pulse Audio controls have way more range than the stuff built into the Mumble.
I still have to set up Pulse Audio. I haven't done that yet, even after the Firefox swap over, I still haven't gotten around to doing the changeover just yet.
By the way, I have a new You may want to look into WaterFox. It's at Firefox 55 level, and it's committed to keeping the current add-in system.
Yeah, that'll have utility for a while, but if there's no more development for the current add-ins, it's not going to help much.
There is something it seems to want, a late GLIBC, I mean a recent GLIBC, and on my Ubuntu 16.04 box, I've been having a devil of a time with the profile directory not having the writable permissions for the application. It'll create a profile directory and then say it can't write to it. It works fine under my Sparky last I tried it. But it is fast, and it is committed to the old school Firefox edit.
Well, as usual, we've spent a lot of the pre-show on some pretty good content. Do we want to slide into the show?
What, you mean do an intro and just continue on with what we're talking about?
Well, that's what we do a lot of times.
Okay.
What organization rears its ugly head?
So who wants to be mother?
I nominate Fweeb.
I'll take it. I haven't stumbled over my own words in a while. Welcome to the Linux Lugcast. We are an open podcast / lug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. If you'd like to join us, please visit linuxlugcast.com for the server details. We also have a Mumble how-to on the site explaining how to configure Mumble. Then just join us in the Linux Lugcast room. During the live show, if you're unable to join us in Mumble, you can listen to us streaming live. You can also join us on IRC on Freenode on the Linux Lugcast channel. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to discuss, please email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. We also have a Google Plus community site and mailing list. Visit our website for the direct links. This is episode 86. I'm hosting today. I'm Fweeb. And with us we have 5150.
Howdy, folks.
Honky Magoo.
Evening.
And Netminer.
Hello, everyone. And welcome, ye strangers who haven't been here a while.
That would be me.
And me last week. Ooh, so, okay, what you're saying that the stream is down.
Oh, no. And just after I spent all that time talking about how it existed. In any case, you want to continue discussion or you want to talk listener feedback stuff first?
Yeah, I don't see any link from Father Finch here in the Lugcast to show that he got in and is producing the stream. So that's why, K-Wisher, that's why it's not on online. None of us here to have anything to do with the stream.
I keep telling myself I need to learn how to do that. I've been thinking... I should probably, on one of these machines, just set up OBS, because OBS should be able to take care of a stream.
Right. We should be backstopping Father Fence so that he doesn't have to, you know, do it every week, then run off to work. As far as Linux feedback, what I'm showing here is, looks like the topics that I posted in last month's show notes. Are you sure that was what you intended to do?
We have a...
Sorry, did you check out the links, or is that the links that you put in the show notes?
Yeah, that's the links for my show notes last week, or 2 weeks ago.
Okay, then maybe that was some sort of a bot that sent that email.
Okay, I guess I missed that email, because I don't remember. I surely would have remembered seeing content for myself.
Like I said, that came back from somebody called Vix. It was... Vix@eq.by. And this bot just take your show notes verbatim and then repost them in and then send it to our feedback?
Sure looks like what it must have done.
Wow, that tells you how much I pay attention when I do the show notes. I just pretty much do a copy and paste.
I mean, that last line where it says, but it was like 2 years ago, so I cannot recall for sure. I don't remember saying that. But all the rest of it, definitely, there's the talking about trying to put the Google Play Store on my 7-inch Amazon so I could use as a monitor for my DJI 3. And went and the link to the Lifehacker page that I used, and then I bet that's what it is. He's quoting me and then the XDA developer. Okay, that wasn't part of what I did. So okay, thank Fix. What he's talking about is this is what he used to put the Play Store on his Amazon Fire. So all right, so that's new material.
So the first half is what you wrote verbatim, and then the second half was how he got it to work was the link to the XDA developer. Okay.
Right, and thanks, Vix. I'll check that out. Probably you're right. It's 2 years ago, so they've probably updated things and closed whatever backdoor that was used to do it, but I'll still look into it. And also, there was this link here from Kay Wisher. He didn't really comment anything, just pretty much a link. RAID on hard drives. Just a minute. I got to convert that to a link and then open it up. We'll see what he's talking about.
From what I saw when I clicked on it, it's background information. Actually, it's a pretty good sort of summary overview of various types of RAID configurations and why it's smart to have a RAID set up. I mean, that's the long and short of it.
Okay, I think a lot of us probably, unless we want to talk about a review of the different forms of RAID, I'm sure there's probably a lot of people who have a pretty good handle on it and a lot of listeners who don't, so we don't have a lot of other content this evening. I guess we can talk about that briefly.
That's just reminds me that I still have to get my... I had my little external RAID. I think it overheated, and I still haven't had a chance to sit down and troubleshoot it to see what went sideways in it. But that I'm running on mine, I believe, if I recall... it was running RAID 10. If I repurpose it and get that set back up, I may switch back over to RAID 5. And there's sort of pros and cons to either one of them. And that article actually, like I said, doesn't do a bad job of explaining that.
Well, years ago, I was wanting to build a MythTV server, and it was on a P4, and I knew that really wasn't as fast as what the software wanted. So I set up Fade be a little faster. I took a couple of junk drives and set up a RAID array, at least to make reads and writes faster. And this is RAID 0, which is not the safe one. That's the one you use for maybe a video games machine, or you would have in the old days, because you're not getting any backup. So if you get a glitch on one drive, you've lost the data on both of them. It's a striped array, writes one packet to one drive, then writes the other packet to the other drive and vice versa and all that. So makes your read and writes fast, but absolutely, no backup of data. And I never got to miss I never got the MythBox built on top of it, but I did once have a P4 with a working RAID array, software RAID installed. RAID 1, you're still using two drives, but in that case you're doing a full duplicate. So if one drive dies hard, you still got a complete set of your data on the other drive. And while not as fast as RAID 0, it does, when you do a write to the drive, I think it still stripes it, and then, in the background fills the rest in. So your initial write's faster, but It's staying there working in the background to make a complete duplicate of your data. RAID 5 uses one of the drives just as a parity between the other two drives, so it's similar to RAID 0, but I guess you can see. No, okay, yeah, it is striped, but since you have the third parity disk, if one of them, one drive dies, supposedly you can recreate the data. And RAID 6 is just uses four drives with double parity, and that makes it possible you could lose two disks and still recover your data out of the four. Okay, RAID 0 plus 1 is like two sets of stripe drives. So, you know, within each pair, you're not going to have redundancy of data, but then you have that second pair that is redundant. Yeah, and somebody's talking on Voxer, but my phone's in the other room, so. Okay, yeah, let's see, RAID 10. You're getting above my pay grade here, but reverse of the previous one. It's, oh, okay. It's, in this case, the drives are connected by, it's striped, but you have two pairs of, or a pair of the first stripe and a pair of the second stripe. Rather than the pair being, the first, like I said, when you do stripe, you write the first packet to one drive, the second packet to the other drive, and alternate. So in this case, RAID 10, you've got four drives, and it's paired off by the two that are the same that have half the data, and then the other two are the same and have the other half of the data.
Well, it's sort of. RAID 10 is a combination of RAID 1 and RAID 0. So what you end up with is you have a set of a pair of drives that are striped, and then those drives are mirrored to another pair of striped drives. And when I set my RAID up to be RAID 10, it was basically it's kind of a data integrity play. And someone will correct me if I get this wrong, but if your parity drive goes south on RAID 5, then recovery can be painful and complex, though you get more drive space with a RAID 5 setup. With RAID 10, you have a little bit less chance of things going entirely pear-shaped, and you can pretty much always recover from at least one drive failure on a RAID 10 setup. And I believe your read throughput tends to be a little bit faster. Writing doesn't, there's not much difference in that between that RAID 10 and RAID 5, if I recall, but I do believe since you're able to multiplex your reads over multiple drives, I believe your read rate is slightly better. And again, if I'm wrong with that, then someone please tell me. And I just saw in the IRC, K Wisher has moved his home server to ZFS. I've yet to delve into the realm of ZFS. It intrigues me, but I've had too many other priorities that haven't let me really, really play with it.
Now I'm interested, Phoebe, what kind of hardware interface did you use to allow you to connect four drives? I know back in the old IDE days, you had, you know, usually IDE 1 and IDE 0 and IDE 2, and, you know, each of those cables could support two drives, the master and the slave. But your latest SATA machines, you've just pretty much got SATA 1, SATA 2, one drive apiece. So what have you got that you can attach four drives to?
I have an external enclosure that's connected through eSATA. So, I mean, SATA as an interface if you have the plugs, it can support a whole bunch of them. And technically, I think you can daisy chain them, but you no wait, no, you can't. But a lot of modern motherboards, especially server grade motherboards, will have I've 6 to 8 SATA plugs right on it, and that's in addition to eSATA, and you can chain some of that out. And so I have an eSATA connection running to an enclosure, and inside the enclosure itself has 4 SATA connections that hook up to that.
Okay, I kind of anticipated that answer, but I thought the listeners would probably be interested.
There's something called port multiplexing, which allows one connection to be spread among a number of things in a back plane or external enclosure.
Now, getting back to the article, it says RAID 50. That's a lot like RAID 0 plus 1, but now you're up to 6 drives because you've got a parity drive. So, you've got the 2 stripe drives in. No, I guess not. You're actually striping across 4 drives, and then you have 2 parity drives. And by that I mean, first packet to get written to drive 1, second packet to get written to drive 2. Drive 3 would be parity for those two. Third packet would go to drive 4. Fourth packet would go to drive 5. And then drive 6 would be parity for that pair.
What if we just go back to what would to the whole ZFS thing? What would be the advantages of a ZFS over let's say EXT4?
Well, ZFS from this again, I've only got a cursory understanding of it based on what little I've read and overhearing conversations about it and those sort of things. So again, grains of salt and all that. But with EXT4 and most conventional even journaling file systems, they're pretty fixed in space. I mean, you can use stuff like Parted and whatnot to manage them, but if you want to do things like stripe against multiple disks or set up mirroring or have a dynamically resizable drive space and hot swaps, that you for that you're talking about doing software RAIDs and or hardware RAIDs and doing that. A file system like ZFS handles a lot of that behind the scenes for you. I mean, it's not a panacea. It's not, a magic button, but it's kind of as close as you're going to get to that kind of thing. You maintain data integrity, but you have the flexibility of swapping out the structure of your drives, what you're actually using for drives and how you're mirroring them and striping them and whatnot. The file system handles a lot of that for you. And that's basically what it comes down to is if you're doing maintenance on your data and have to maintain all that sort of thing where hardware does change and that kind of thing happens a lot, it's just a lot less headache and very, very happily facilitates laziness, which is in this case a good thing.
That is ZFS support versioning.
Built into the OS, file system. I know it's a journaling file system, so I mean there's the ability I think to do rollbacks on the file system level, but like if you're talking about versioning like you would see in Git or Mercurial, I'm not so sure, but that now we're treading into the realm where I definitely have a bunch of ignorance.
ZFS does a lot of things about allowing snapshotting and stuff like that.
I think that's more of what I was thinking of then.
Also, ZFS has an inter-server transport built into it, so you can have two separate servers that update the same data set or mirror the data set across servers. It runs well on dumb hardware, but the memory requirements for efficiency tend to be steep.
Just a quick little side note. So my work, the one of the backends that runs all the kind of purchasing, well, all the type of sales type of stuff that can, that shows like how much business you're doing or stuff like that, doesn't, I don't think it handles any of the credit card type stuff. But those systems, they have them set up, and they have them only set up as a RAID 1, and it boggles the mind as to why they didn't just spend the money, get another hard drive, and go for the RAID 5. Because RAID 1 is nice, but it's not very reliable as a good, we've actually had times where both RAIDs go down. So I don't think it's a very reliable solution, as opposed to just get another hard drive and do RAID 5.
It depends on what you're trying to do, though. I mean, I at the minimum on any of my workstations, I have RAID 1. If you're looking to like double drive failure at the same time is terrifying. And if you're looking to have increased capacity, then yeah, RAID 5 is definitely a probably a better option. But the reason I do RAID primarily is for data integrity. So I hope that both drives don't go pear shaped at the same time, and in that case I at least have, oh, because it's mirroring, I always have a secondary copy of whatever goes on there. It's poor man's backup that goes before an actual backup.
Right. And the $1 million corporation shouldn't be running something that's a poor man's backup. Spend the extra couple of dollars, get the extra hard drive, and actually do an actual RAID. Or an actual stable RAID, for that matter. Sorry, just one of those things that IT guy at my work and I have joked about many times, so I've figured I'd throw it out up there.
And here I am with no two machines having a pair of drives the same size. Hell, I'm barely into LVM and stuff yet.
Yeah, and I never did mess with LVM all that much. I pretty much stuck pretty close to the metal on that. And that's, if you're back to your question on ZFS sort of also kind of obviates the need for something like LVM. Also, I said obviate.
Sorry, 50, I didn't mean to completely derail you there.
No, not at all. I've been very rapt listening to this discussion. Thanks for bringing it into the show. And it's made me think, this one tower, it's down, want to bring it back up. And definitely want to see if I can recover Solus OS. I think what's going on, I'm not sure if discussed that or not, because I wanted to come as a finished solution. But with the whole blinking cursor after grub, a lot of the stuff I found is, yeah, there was an update and they screwed up the video driver somehow. So main stuff that I've looked into is there are ways to get into grub, tell it, you know, to turn advanced graphics off, just, you know, load normal graphics and you should be able to get into it. And then from that, I don't know if you update again, cross your fingers, hope that it fixes the video driver. But that's kind of what I'm looking at on that machine. Now, after that, now that I've found out how to install, I still want to maintain a Solus desktop somewhere, but I've got that new machine, I can move it over there, and I'm considering, well, do I want to take all that storage that I had for Solus and just convert the whole thing to true OS? And of course, you know, the ZFS discussion we've had, the main reason for the true OS would be that I'd be able to actually run, not emulated, but their setup to run the Windows version of Steam under Solus, and they or not under Solus, under TrueOS, and they claim that they can run it faster than you can on a Windows box of equivalent hardware. I've got 6 gig of RAM, but that's maxed out. So maybe interesting to see if that would be enough RAM for both CFS and a high end game.
Well, I've heard people throwing around 16 gig minimums for TrueOS. And stuff like, or for ZFS, so good luck with six.
Okay, well, maybe that should shape my opinion. I'll do a little more research then, before I just throw TrueOS at it.
Also, what you may end up finding to be useful is having a data server of some kind, whatever machine you can stuff the most memory on, and having TrueOS talk to that.
Yeah, I'll consider that. Probably for gaming, that's going to be a huge bottleneck, too. No.
Just Gigabyte. Between the two machines, just direct link, bonded, gigabit Ethernet.
True, but if I'm going to build a machine with the, 16 gigabytes, I might as well just put a motherboard in the one I have that's, put in an i5 or an i7 and 16 gig and run it direct from there. It wouldn't be more expensive. Okay, getting back to the RAID article 1, the one last iteration that they talk about is RAID 60, which is double parity plus stripe. So again, striped against four drives and just two parity drives. It's not redundant parity drives. The parity drives are striped in this case too, across four. So, okay, well, that's a total of eight drives, and that's as far as the article goes. So, one of these solutions will probably work out for everybody. Okay, I had some topics that, unfortunately, none of them are technically directly Linux-related, though they do deal with some of the hardware that we talk about on this show. First one is the ReSpeaker. It's like a four-speaker hat for Raspberry Pi. this was posted to Google Plus by Jay Rulo. Apparently, he, like I do, he has a Mycroft AI. Unlike me, since I had that problem, I reported that every time I plugged it back in, it wanted to re-register with Mycroft Mothership. It's still sitting here on my desk in here instead of in the living room where I first had it. But I guess Jay Rulo's done some more testing with his, and he brought up some consideration that I hadn't even thought of, was that if there's anything else on, like the TV or music or whatever in the room, it really doesn't understand when you try to talk to it. And I hadn't even thought to test that. Probably just assumed that, yeah, you're not going to get much response from it if there's any other sound going on in the room. But he posted this CNX software article. And the article is about the ReSpeaker hat. If you scroll down, there's a link where it says price $25. That's where you actually buy it. but I thought the CNX software article probably has more detail about the device. And with the four speaker array, that gives it, you know, more excuse me, I guess it's more likely if you're talking to it to pick you out of the overhead noise around the room, and, you know, probably get you from a lot further away across the room rather than right next to the device. Some other features are that there is like a graphical ring around the top, and it will point to the direction that the sound is coming from. So if it's in a case, I don't know how much good that's going to do. Also, it does cover all the GPIO pins, which may not be the greatest thing if you're using this in a project. So I guess there's a couple pins that passes out to the side, but I don't know if there's a way you can put something in between or whatever, you know, because surely it's not using all the GPIO pins to do what it does. But if you're building, you know, doing yourself Alexa or Google Home or one of the many open source versions of those projects that we've talked about on the show here, this is probably going to make nicer mic than like the one I picked up. The plug-in was just go in the audio input plug. Especially, I've been worried about, you know, if I put it in a case. I've been seriously considering. I picked up an old non-functional Atari 2600 box, and, you know, if I put something from microphone inside there, I'm pretty sure the louvers on the things are non-functional. You know, is it going to hear anything, or am I just going to have to set it out there, you know, put the whole system laying out there bare for it to actually function. There was a article does talk about there is some stuff in there for to you can set up voice commands and recognize it. I mean, because like the Alexa that was released, it says you have to have a physical switch. It's not going to respond to a command. So I don't know if it's gonna, you know, could you set that up so that it's listening for a particular command and you tell it, okay, you know, if you hear that command, then replicate grounding these two GPIO pins together, and that would simulate a button push that would then would make Alexa or Google Home talk. I'm probably going to get one of these to play with, but I'm also thinking that maybe some programming is necessary. It's not just something you click on there and everything works. I think they had a article mentions they had a standalone device. I think 16 speakers. That was just kind of its own device, and then they had a dual speaker. I mean, sorry, 16 microphones. I'll bring the article up here real quick. I should have done that already. And you know, like a dual one for Pi Zero. So there are other products out there by the same people. I'm opening the link now, so I'll clarify that last part. But if you want to do an Alexa project, you haven't already got your microphone, instead of spending $10 for a little plug-in one, you know, maybe $25 for this would be well spent. Okay, I guess they had an IoT board, Internet of Things, with optional microphone array board with 7 microphones and 12 LEDs. So, okay, it was an optional deal, but they had their, it was plugged into their own IoT device. And then there's $10 tube microarray for the Raspberry Pi Zero. Another interesting thing, you may recall, I think about 2 months ago, probably about the time I did the review on the Mycroft, that I predicted at some point these are going to be consumer devices, and instead of each one having its own individual features, they're going to sort of amalgamate, so they can all talk to each other and work together, and that's beginning to happen. Apparently, it's not done yet, but Amazon and Microsoft are collaborating so that if you have both Cortana and Alexa or an Echo on the same network, you can access one from the other. So in other words, you could be on your Windows 10 machine and say to Cortana, open up Alexa and play music on the Echo, and you could talk to Alexa and ask Cortana and maybe bring up a map or something. So they're not going to start duplicating each other's functionality yet, but they're going kind of in that direction. They can use each other's resources. And there's no comment from any other manufacturers, but Jeff Bezos, and that's not in the article. I originally saw it a different place. But Jeff Bezos saying he would be willing to work with Google and any other manufacturers of personal audio assistants. So we have any commentary? You guys hear me?
We're here. I didn't have anything really to add to that. I think it's a cool idea. I haven't had any desire right now to build anything like that, but I might in the future. And if so, I'll probably use something like this.
Yeah, I'm not into the voice command environment just yet. I'm still barely thrashing around with X.
Well, right, and I'm sort of on the wall, hey, this would be really cool to let the NSA know everything that's going on in my house. So yeah, I like it. If I build one myself, I figure I got a little more control over it. But I can also unplug it as well once I've played with it. So, it seems like a fascinating project to me. Doesn't mean I'm going to necessarily leave it running in my house all the time. And I think I mentioned, I'm kind of fascinated with this Tesla technology for the home. I don't think I'd ever be interested in having an electric car. But Elon Musk has said, oh, yeah, we're going to have the photoelectric shingles that will power your home, and they won't cost any more they'll even be cheaper than normal asphalt shingles. And kind of wish he'd gotten this technology done before he'd built the house, but let's face it, here in central part of the U.S., it's probably going to be 7 or 8 years before there's even anybody who could install something like that. By that time, I'll probably be needing a new roof. Question is if I can get the insurance company to pay for replacing it with the photoelectric shingles. The rub was the power wall and how many of those, because I'd like to have it so in all weather conditions, or I was thinking, well, the power wall would probably come before the shingles, and I did analysis on What it would cost to set it up for, you know, have 2 days power under normal use, if the electricity went off. And I think, you know, I think that like the power walls, at least current price, are still about $2,500 installed, maybe more than that, I'm not sure. And I for 2 days, I'd need at least four of them. And look, that's an, I don't know any way I could ever pencil that out. So there has been, you know, there's been some do-it-yourself projects out there to build power walls using old laptop battery cells. And you've probably seen a lot of these things on Hackaday where people have done that. They've taken, you know, broken apart the case for the quote laptop battery and then pulled the cells out of it. And even ones that seem dead, apparently if you break them out of there, there are ways to get them to recharge. I mean, sometimes it takes a while, but you can usually bring life back to them. And if you look at some of the pictures on these, it, you know, you probably need upwards of 1,000 of them to equate to a power wall. But still, when you look at the pic, you know, well, I don't know how many, several hundred at least, but apparently there is a movement to work on do-it-yourself. Now, if everybody did this, there wouldn't be enough used laptop batteries to go around, but no bigger than our audience is. I probably not shooting myself too much in the foot by letting everybody know about this. The link I put in is DIYpowerwalls.com. That's just a forum, but if you look on YouTube, if you do look for a do-it-yourself power wall, there's a bunch of videos out there on how people set those up. And that brings me to when I was looking, wasn't really looking for a laptop, came across one I thought was a good price. But at the bottom of the page on eBay, in the, you know, you may also be interested in, I was surprised to find there's a bunch of, you know, like 14-inch Core 2 Duo laptops, almost all of them, no hard drive. So corporate laptops, they yank the hard drive, but $35. And, you know, go to think of that, you know, that versus a Raspberry Pi. You say, well, laptop has no storage. So, well, Raspberry Pi has no storage. I mean, if you're going to use it as a file server, you could boot the laptop from an SD card, I guess, if you wanted to. So, of course, it's going to take more power. I've always wondered, you know, again, if you're doing it for storage, if you set up a Raspberry Pi plugged into a spinning USB drive, how does that compare to a laptop with a spinning drive? Is it that much difference? And of course, an Intel dual core processor is still going to run circles around an ARM. But the reason I bring that up, I'm kind of digressing. those would be, a source for, you know, the articles I talked about, well, buying old laptop batteries, but yeah, you can probably get the same price. You get the whole laptop batteries included. And a lot of these old laptops, I'm pretty sure most Dells, you take the battery out, it's, even if you plug it in the power, it doesn't want to run. So, but you could look at that. I mean, if you're going to set one of these up, you know, have your cake and eat it too. Buy it for the cells, and then have a much more powerful computer for $35, just plugged in the power all the time. So something to throw out there and for everybody to ponder.
Yeah, I'd definitely look into that if I was in the market for another laptop. But I got enough. I got three of them here that I'm trying to put to certain uses, and Yeah, I just haven't found the right use for all of them, but they all have good operating systems on them, and they all run. So.
Yeah, I was just kind of blown away, and they're only gonna get cheaper. I mean, I knew the floor was gonna fall out of the Core 2s pretty soon, since we've had the I series for 10 years almost. So, yep, all these people say, well, I got, I paid $600 for this computer 10 years ago. Surely I can sell it for 200. Nope. Weeb, I believe you're up.
Yeah, well, mine's not much of an add-on here. It's just, and it's not even exactly Linux related, but a number of us are doing it with open source tools, so it is kind of related. And that is that this is September 1st, so officially Sculptember has started. As far as I know, I actually started Sculptember, but I'm not entirely sure. That's a couple of years ago. I think I was on this podcast at that point. I was doing what I was calling a creative trimonthlon. And so if you're familiar with NaNoWriMo, which is the National Novel Writing Month in November, and Inktober, which is an ink drawing challenge throughout the month of October, there wasn't anything for September, so I decided that there would be a Sculptember. And so it is what it sounds like. Every day is doing some kind of sculpting throughout the course of the month. Most of it's going to be digital, so you see people working in Blender and other 3D software like that. But as far as I'm concerned, anybody can play as long as it's in 3 dimensions. So mashed potato sculptures are perfectly acceptable. But yeah, so that's if anybody's interested in doing that, follow along. It's all over a number of different social media stuff. So I know I'll be putting it up on Mastodon and Twitter and Instagram and those places. So yeah.
Yeah, you may want to include your website URL for the people who have forgotten monsterjavaguns.com, is it not?
That is my website, yeah, which is actually I need to do some updates to it. I haven't updated that site in some time. So I have previous Sculptembers things that I've made are I've put them in little galleries on that site. And when this year's one is done, I'll probably be adding that there as well.
Well, I just wanted to let friendly folks know it's worth a trip over there just to see the stuff that comes out of Phoebe's mind.
Yeah, we haven't heard an open source creative in a while.
Yeah, I've had an unexpected summer hiatus. It'll be back. It'll be back.
You were on a roll there for a while, where you were what, every week, like clockwork.
Yeah, I was keeping up with it pretty well. I had some a little bit of travel and stuff that kicked me right out of keeping up with it, and I haven't been able to get back in the stride. But I will. I will.
Yeah, it's always rough once you get kicked out of your groove.
If I were smart, I'd pre-record them.
Actually, I haven't been to the Lugcast website in a while. But is there any way we could put in a segment for individual things like this, that may be just sort of an et cetera. Here's my site for open source this or creative writing or whatever.
Well, just for you, we added a section on LinuxLoudcast.com, which I think is labeled as extra listening. Hold on, let me bring up our site again. Suggested listening.
Actually, I have a new section that Java Guns would fit perfectly.
Suggested websites?
Linux Lugcast likable links.
Likeable links. I like it. Ah.
Yes,
I see
very
what you
nice.
did there.
That's where your creative writing stuff, everything, none of the above. I'm planning on putting up a website, but unless you're in my house, you probably won't get to it.
Well, how do you get to your house?
I think we just got all invited, didn't we?
No, I'm going to start. I may do a blog, but I may do, with the new server, I may try to sandbox my stuff, and then what I put on the outside is stuff that's been pre-digested on my private Notional server.
Are you going to try host it yourself, or are you going to host it somewhere else?
The internal one will be self-hosted, of course. The external one, I haven't decided whether I'm going to dig into Blogger or whatever. The recent events in my life have given me some things to say, and I'm hoping to go more active on creation instead of consumption, but all of this is very tentative at the moment, and I figure if I work things out on an internal server of some kind, then I'll know when I want to put it in production, or at least high exposure, what I may want to put out and what I may want to keep confidential.
That seems like a smart way to go.
And if I may, I've become a big proponent of the static site generators. So as what you're looking into, I would highly recommend looking into the likes of Hugo and Jekyll. Especially since Jekyll's developed by the folks at GitHub, you can actually use GitHub as your host as well. Just use GitHub Pages. So just an option to toss in there for external stuff if you want to do that sort of route.
I'll have to really think about it. But right now, I have networked computers, but whenever I'm doing updates on anything, each machine has to do its own downloads and stuff, which on DSL can be pretty lame.
I think I mentioned it last show. I'll mention it again. I've got flight and reservations booked for Ohio Linux Fest here at the end of this month. I don't haven't looked yet to see how that lines up with our schedule, if I'm going to miss a show or not. But it's just weird. I'm this year, a lot of the podcasters that are usually the usual suspects up there are not going to be able to make it. I know, so probably see some of the people who are in the area that show up, but I don't know if doesn't sound like anybody's willing to travel much distance to get to it this year. Not going to have a table this year, unless somebody else has worked that out behind, you know, not told me, but far as I know, there isn't going to be a podcaster's table this year, so. But I'd probably be pretty hard to miss walking around. So, and you guys have listeners could probably find my email, or you know, if somebody says, "Hey, wants to contact the show. I'm going to OLF and I want to meet 5150." Nah, I can't imagine anybody wants to meet 5150. But just in case, contact the show. And we'll work it out. I guess that's all I had for OLF.
I'd want to meet 5150, though I can't go to Ohio, though.
Yeah, but you guys are weird.
Well, yeah.
It's going to be real sad being at Barley's drinking beer and eating fried sauerkraut by myself.
Is Joel not going to go?
Oh, yeah. He's. I know he's planning to. He's kind of in and out since he lives there, though. And I expect, well, I haven't heard anything negative from the SMLR folks or Kevin O'Brien, so I'd expect to see them there probably.
Is Alan going to go?
Who?
Alan from Tilts.
Oh, Alan. Well, that's weird. I accused Pat, you know, I said, oh, I'll see, since I was on Facebook, I'll see you there, because maybe it was Alan who said he was going to present. You know, I could have swore it was Pat, but, you know, I get confused.
You saying Alan's going to do a talk?
Well, I don't know. Somehow I got in my head somebody on Tilt so that they had presented a talk. I don't know if they got to do, never heard if they got to do the talk or whatever. I was thinking it was Pat, and Pat was says, no, I don't plan to talk this year. So, I don't know. Maybe, I know Dor's not coming, or Rich, probably not. I guess that's not firm yet. Mini PC podcast that I listened to, they were both pretty, not likely. You know, sound like Dan was going to come and now he's not. So,
yeah, I think somebody, I don't remember whether it was Alan, but somebody said that they were, they submitted a talk late and they didn't hear back from anybody, more or less.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sure whoever's there, we all gravitate towards each other.
So I got one quick kind of topic. So I finally bought and assembled a 3D printer. I bought the Tronxy X1 off of GearBest, and so it arrived. And I've been playing around with Slicer software. So we've talked about this in the past, where where you create images in things like CAD. Tinkercad or whatever, you create the 3D images into STL files, then you import the STL files into what's called slicer programs, and the slicer programs turn those STL files into G-code, which is basically just commands to the printer, you know, where to move the head around, because the head is just basically heating up the plastic and continuously moving around. And the speed and rate it moves around and where it moves around is how the image is basically created. So it creates all the code that that gives the direction to the G code, the direction to the 3D printer to get it to work. So one of the more popular slicer programs is one out there called Cura. And Cura has a Linux version, and the Linux version from I don't know which version on, but in the last several versions of Cura, they have been sending their image out. They've been sending their program out, distributing it through AppImage. And AppImage is kind of like the same idea as like Flatpak or what's the one that Ubuntu does?
Snap.
Thank
Snap.
You.
But I will say that AppImage does predate both of them.
And so it takes everything that you basically need for that application and then throws it all together into one big old file. And the way, which I will, before I publish the show, I will get which episode of GNU World Order that he goes into great detail into app images. Klaatu goes into great detail about it. He talks about how like they're created and different and the ways to create them. But basically, it takes everything that you need for that application, compiles it into one, which is basically an ISO file, and then you're able to run it. Basically, all you need to do to get a app image to run is to download the app image through chmod. A plus X to make it executable, the app image file, and then from the command line, you'd run it almost the same way as you would run a bash script. So you do, you know, dot slash and then cura dot, well, whatever version dot app image, and it just starts up and runs. Or if I think you can just, once it's executable, all you have to do is, if you go through a file manager, all you have to do is double click on the image and it should just start up and run. So that's it. I mean, it just runs. It just works. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and the advantage to that is, you know, all your dependencies that are installed with the application are, you know, the version that is right for that application. So if you install another application that calls for, you know, a newer version, and things shouldn't break, but potentially they could, you know, but, you know, you get a newer version, in the conventional way through repositories, that, you know, that you, install software, you might have a dependency, or you might upgrade that software, and then suddenly it doesn't work with, other piece of software on your system, where with the Flatpak sort of thing, everything is kind of sandboxed and self-contained. Now, it's also a disadvantage because it takes up, you know, multiple copies of the same software take up more space on your hard drive, but storage is cheap these days.
Right. I was going to say, the only disadvantage that I can see is it creates a larger file, you know, because it has everything already piled into this one file, that it's going to create a much larger file.
I think the term where ducking is an ancient one. It's called static linking.
Yep. And, you know, I can see another disadvantage maybe, you know, when they do updates, if there's an update for a dependency available, they may look at it and say, no, we know the one we got works, so we'll go with it. So I'm wondering if everything is going to stay as fresh as it would be with the old repository system. But, you know, I guess stable may be better than fresh, except in security situations.
Well, and sometimes, especially like with a lot of the software that I use, they tend to be a lot more modern with their libraries than distributions tend to be. So for like Krita, for instance, does app images and ships them for that, because it uses a number of libraries that simply, unless you do a whole array of different PPAs, if you're trying to work in Ubuntu, it's a nightmare trying to get that installed using system libraries. Likewise, Blender, they use, you know, they've been using all sorts of new stuff for that for ages. And so Blender hasn't been using App Image or Flatpak or anything like that. Blender just does static linking and ships a tarball, and you can just basically decompress it and run it from wherever. And that works rather well in those scenarios where you really can't necessarily count on the distribution having libraries that are as up to date, or even in some cases, the Blender devs will make patches that they send upstream, but the patches haven't been accepted upstream yet, but Blender still wants to ship a release, so they'll do a static link that way.
So you're saying you may actually have more advanced versions of the dependencies that way than you would have with the repository system.
In some cases, yeah. Now, the counter argument is that those may not be vetted by the distro maintainers for bugs or security fixes or you know, consistency with whatever library structure the distro is using. But in terms of the application that's doing it, I mean, for instance, Blender was one of the first programs to use OpenColor.io and open subdiv libraries, and those libraries didn't ship with the distros. And so unless you went through and compiled it yourself or did a number of other little sort of nuanced dances, it was kind of a pain to set that up. So having the packaged static linked means of approach was an advantage, has been an advantage in that case.
So K-Wisher is pointing out in IRC that there is a PPA for Cura. I tried looking, tried getting the PPA to install on my which machine is this? I tried to get the PPA to work, and for whatever reason, I got like every time it would update, I'd get a 404 error on whatever the PPA was calling to. So unfortunately, it didn't seem to work for me. I'd rather go through the PPA and have it like install on my system, because it seems to running out of the app image on this computer, because I think it's just a little bit older machine. It seems it takes a while for the Cura to load, while I have another slicer program called Idea Maker that starts up automatically and runs. I wonder if I could actually install it, whether it would take less time to start up the program. But either way, I mean, I definitely not going to talk bad about an app image program. If I could, too, I just want to do a quick little commentary. So I bought the 3D printer off of GearBest. I bought this, so when you buy off of GearBest, it'll ask like which warehouse and different versions. I bought the European version that came with the European plug. So I went to Amazon and bought myself a plug adapter. And when it arrived, I had actually gotten, they actually sent me a plug adapter. So I have now have two plug adapters. And at the same time, I really didn't even need a plug adapter, because the power supply for it was, it was kind of like a laptop brick, and it had the three prongs on it. It's the same three prongs that are with pretty much every power supply out there. And I had a freaking box of those anyways. So I put one of those in. So now I'm sitting on two EU to US power adapters. And also, if you were running a Tronxy X1, X3, there is a Facebook group. I'm not big on big or active on Facebook, but they seem to be the biggest, the most knowledgeable people and the most responsive people if you have any questions or problems to on these devices. And I had a problem the other day where everything seemed to be shifting a little bit. I posted a question onto there, and within minutes there was like four or five responses from people. So I can't sing these people's praises high enough. They seem to be great people. And I know a lot of people who probably talk bad about GearBest and that have had problems with it, but I got everything out of the box. It seems like I've gone through many videos, because I am a very cautious assembler when it comes to anything. I will like read the directions six or seven times before actually doing some things. So I like watched several videos over and over again, and it seems like a lot of the things that I saw were problems in those videos. It seems like they're trying to fix. Like one of the things was there were parts that seemed like they needed washers that didn't come with it, because these are all like DIY kits. You know, they just give you a giant pile of stuff that should make what you were supposed to have, and then you put it all together. And if there are like things that are a little bit off, or like in some cases people have talked about having parts missing, these are parts that you can just go to like the hardware store and buy these screws. So these are like these are true kits. But it seems like they're throwing these, they seem to do a lot better with where people are having problems. They seem to be trying to fix those problems or add stuff to the kits to help fix with the problems. Like there was washers that were missed that somebody was talking about, that they really needed to get something put on. And I saw that it came with a bag of washers, but I didn't know that they were probably meant for that. So I scrambled around looking for my own to try to fix it on my own, thinking that, you know, I was going to have the same problem as this person did that I saw on the video. And turned out I probably could have just used those washers and could have spent less time running around looking for friggin' washers. That and like the people talk about the power brick, they start calling it the fire brick, because that thing apparently would get super hot and it burnt out for people. I don't know whether it's because of the fact that the power adapter that I'm using is it's a three prong adapter, as opposed to everything else, which seems to be a two prong with the three prong with the ground. If that makes a difference at all, but mine I've left it plugged in. I haven't left it plugged into the machine, but I've left it just plugged in by itself, and it's run really cool. So I'm maybe, you know, knock on wood, it's not going to have the same problems as other people do, because like I said, other people called it, they refer to the power brick as basically a fire brick, because everyone was having problems with it overheating. But yeah, that's my little rant and commentary. The Tronxy X1 Facebook group, it seems to be a really good set of people who, if you have questions, they will be happy to answer anything about it, try to help you with any problems that you have. And GearBest actually seems to be doing, I know some people had problems, but they seem to be working towards trying to give you a good product, even though it, you know, it's going to take a little while for you to get the product because it's coming from a China warehouse. Mine didn't seem to be that bad, though. It didn't seem to be that long to get it. But that's my rant.
Okay. Sorry. One thing. I know in a recent episode of The Makers, Rich said that there is a way to make a power supply for a 3D printer out of at least an old ATX power supply, maybe even an AT, I don't know. Might not be the right voltages. Definitely ATX. You can make a cooler running power supply from one of those. I'm on the makers page on podnuts.com because you were talking about your slicer, and they did an in-depth episode on the different types of slicers and what they run on. And I clear back in episode 2, they talk about a bunch of them in the show notes, but I don't think that was the in-depth one, you know, what they're using on what and what, you know, what the various advantages are to one slicer program over another. So my advice to anybody, you've got a 3D printer, if you're not already listening to The Makers, start. It's on podnuts.com. That's podnutz.com. I imagine anybody that's found us has found Podnuts long since. But if not, that's their show that they've started for, you know, essentially Makers projects and more specifically 3D printing. So since you know the apparent fire hazard reported on these, Honky, where in your house do you have you located your 3D printer?
It's actually down here. I'm in the basement. I have what was once the previous owner's workbench. So they had taken like an old desk and converted it and put that next to like a regular workbench. So it's the desk part is where I have all my computers and stuff, and right next to it, which was just a standard workbench, I have the 3D printer set up. It's right next to a door, and I have 2 smoke alarms. I don't know, maybe 6 feet away, because they're at the top of the stairs. They're over there. I figure it's just as good a place as any, since my garage goes inside underneath my house too. So it's basically part of my basement. So the best place for it is right now here next to my little computer lab.
Yeah, that's what I thought. You know, Dor talked about putting it out in the garage, and Rich, and you know, I thought, yeah, I figured flame shooting up to the ceiling. It's all the same building. That's not going to help much, but then I figured, oh, I've got a concrete room I can put it in. So, and I've told you guys that. Don't have it in there yet, but I'm not doing anything. So, have you printed anything cool with it yet?
Well, not really. I've done the test cube. I've tried printing some stuff, and I've had an issue where it got up to like a certain height, and then it all started shifting on me. One of the things I'm trying to print, well, there's 2 things I'm really trying to print right now. One is what's called Benchy. It's a boat. It's used as a good solid benchmark for, I mean, if the measurements on that boat are right and the boat comes out looking good, then that's a good way to tell that your 3D printer is set up right. The other one is, which I'm actually I'm printing right now, is it's a little Pac-Man ghost that's maybe about like, I don't know, 4 or 5 centimeters tall, something like that. It's just a tiny little ghost. I figure it is a quick, you know, it'll probably take about 1.5 hours to print a quick little thing that'll look kind of cool. And if it's printed right, I can keep it sitting around, or I can give it to my daughter or something. But it's something that's quick and cool looking. They're also with these things, they're very, like I said, DIY. I've been wanting to print some of the, there's little like upgrade type stuff to it, whether it's, you know, spool holders, which I'm probably going to have to print relatively soon, I think. I got like a little makeshift thing. So my work had, there were like metal stands that they had at the end of registers for trying to sell like those vinyl bags to people, as opposed to trying to get, you know, so people use those as opposed to plastic bags. And one of them had, like, I don't know, part of it broken off or something. So it was just sitting around by the trash. And I figured it was reasonable height. It was a reasonable size and shape for being able to put one of these giant spools on and to get it to work. But I'm not sure whether it's, I think it's it seems to be feeding okay, but I still might want to print out my own spool holder, because they have several types of spool holders that will sit right on the top of where the handle is of this little thing. I mean, it's only it's a small printer. It's 150 millimeter by 150 millimeter by 150 millimeter printer, and like I said, that's a big enough space for. Like, if one of the reasons why I did it is it seemed to be like a big enough space. If I wanted to print out a Pine 64 case, it seems to be big enough just to print out a Pine 64 case if I wanted to. And I can't think of anything much bigger than that I really wanted to play around with or build right now. But I figure this would hopefully be a fun thing to do with, you know, make things for my kids, make cool things for me. And then make cases and stuff for my mini PCs that I have sitting around here, try to put those into some use. At least that was my thinking.
Well, we'll all be looking forward to hearing your experiences with it. Hopefully I can get mine to where it does something. If not, I may go your route. And if you haven't already, can you... put that Gear Best link in the show notes to that model printer.
Sure. No problem.
Oh, and we sort of had a sideways feedback from Starship Tux when I was in the chat for Tilts last Wednesday. He says, "Yeah, I've used Arts for Arm, and just ignore those." Warnings when you're unpacking the file. And I said, well, yeah, I did. And, you know, then I took the SD card and put it in my Odroid U2 and it didn't boot up. And I was using the correct image for the Odroid U2, if anybody was wondering about that. So, and that was one of the things that I meant to do in these last 2 weeks is get a different SD card, start over again, make sure it wasn't SD card contaminated or screwed up somehow after being written so many times. So haven't got to that. I mean, I usually try that once before I just give up on, no, it's software, it ain't gonna work. Well, I think, gentlemen, we've done an amazing job of stretching no topics at all to a whole show again. Yay!
Well actually, I have some ramblings that I'd like to have more experienced Linux people review. Having dealt with a machine with flaky onboard video, or at least untrustworthy onboard video, I'm wondering if a Raspberry Pi or something could be built just as a console computer.
You mean just directly in terminal, or?
I mean something that all it runs are VLC, TeamViewer, whatever, local, and use the 100 megabit link as a console connection instead of so that all your server runs are the server-side components to X2Go or VLC or what have you, and you don't rely on its shitty video. You just have a machine that's more that has modern video that you can hang a modern tube, a modern screen off.
Now it may be going the other way than what you're doing. Fascinating story. I've heard on Everyday Linux. They needed to set up a Windows lab, but they didn't have any fast enough Windows computers to work for it. And essentially, they set up the whole lab with Raspberry Pis, and then used our desktop to remote into the server. So it looked to all the students that they had a Windows desktop.
Well, that's the kind of thing that I'm thinking about. But with using my AMD machine, basically because it has an I/O powerhouse and it'll have it is a SATA machine, even though it's probably SATA 1. But the idea is to have all of the video stuff handled by a more modern sort of like net client. I mean, just have the so dealing with the let's say HDMI or whatever is handled by whatever little Pico PC, Pico, you know, ARM machine or what have you, and it just handles the keyboard and video.
Yeah, I don't see why that shouldn't work. You know, said if you could, probably video over a gigabit Ethernet's going to be better than over 10/100. So, of course, I don't know, unless you're playing games or something like that, probably wouldn't matter that much. But if you could get all the way through gigabit, that's probably going to help.
Well, I'm just talking about a dedicated 10/100. So I've upgraded the primary link to the outside to the network to be gigabit. But also your common ARMs are all 10/100 native.
Oh, I've seen a few gigabit that and on their own bus. So, you know, whether they can actually achieve that, but it's going to be better than a shared 10/100 with the USB.
Well, I'm just, again, I haven't processed the cost of this machine and getting it configured as I want. One of the things that I'm going to put into it is a DVD burner for backups. I've got a couple of pretty good USB DVD burner drives, but in trying to install stuff on this server without an internal DVD, it shows me how terribly slow USB 2 DVD is.
I know there's a new Orange Pi out there that's supposed to have a gigabit NIC on it, and I just got a couple of hats from my old original ones, like the same ones Flying Rich got, that they're about 10, but you know, the computer's about $10 and the hats are about $10. Of course, they get you on the shipping. But the hats have two USB ports and a microphone, so you might be interested more for the two more USB ports. Gives you a place for, dedicated place for a keyboard and a mouse. But you know, that could get you out the door pretty cheap.
Well, again, I'm going to have to just see about this. But I'm just thinking that The onboard video on this machine is Radeon 6100. So any Raspberry Pi will probably run doors or run rings around it video wise. And I'd just like to have the limited resources of the server be a server. With everything else handled by my desktops or a dedicated screen interface, screen and keyboard interface box. This unit will have USB 3, so it's not inconceivable that I could put gigabit USB 3 links on the outside.
Well, it sounds like you got a plan. Now, does the box you're feeding into, does it have a slot for the discrete video card?
It does, but the 710 video card that I was using seemed to be a little too much for the power supply.
Yeah, you get into that. You upgrade one thing, then you got to do the next thing.
But that's exactly why I got this box, so that I could find out if 710s would go in my Asus machines, which are known to have sort of lightweight power supply. I'm also thinking about, since my other machines tend to have some spare disk space, of having a replicated file store between my server and the desktop, so if anything goes down, everybody's got a recent sort of backup.
Well, backup's always a good thing.
Yeah, well, I must admit that a lot of my standards are pretty hacky at the moment, so I'm looking to bring up my game. Also, one of the machines that I have that's working strictly with the on-chip video it may be a nice machine to drop in eSATA there are disk towers that do RAID or JBOD, and they have a card that you drop into a relatively modern machine that just drives the external disks. And I may eventually work up to that kind of standard. I'm just seeing that eventually all of my machines will be, even for YouTube watching or whatever, is going to be obsoleted by the growing bloat and hair of browsers and whatnot. Although I will mention the Brave browser starts up very slow on my systems, but once it's running, it runs like the wind.
Well, that's good, because the ways that, like you said, these other browsers get bloated, we may all be looking for alternatives.
Yeah, well, the whole idea is with Brave is you just let it, at least on my systems, which are modest 64 bits, you let it get started. Maybe go out for coffee. It's not a fast load and go browser like Chrome or whatnot, but once it's loaded, it flies. It's also written by the guy who wrote JavaScript and a bunch of other stuff. Seems like a great browser to have started with when you start your system, and then don't worry about it after. And then just get ready to use it. Just think of it as a part of the slow boot up process.
Well, I remember the days when any computer was like that. You started up and you went and did something for 10 minutes.
Well, it has some Chrome roots, but it's very much its own thing. does some ad blocking. Also, it has its own ad monetization system, which I haven't accessed, activated, but it seems to be an alternative to both the Chrome Universe browsers and the straight Chrome Universe browsers and the Firefox browsers. It's a 0.18 release, so it's got a lot of room for growth.
Well, thanks. I'm looking at both WaterFox and Brave Download now, so I'll try them both before next show.
Quick note, but yep. Isn't Brave only available for download on 64-bit systems?
Looks like it, what I'm looking at here.
Yeah, I think that's why I haven't played around with it yet. I still might, but I have two 64-bit systems, but the one I was looking to play with a lot of browsers on was a 32-bit system, so I haven't played around with that one yet.
I believe Pale Moon is available, but it's an earlier Fox. They call it Fox 24 level, and they've gone their own way. It's pre-Australia. CyberFox, sadly, is locked on to terminate at Firefox 52 level, and I don't know how WaterFox works on 32-bit machines. I've had about a break-even approach, it seems to run great on my Debian testing machines, but it has a little trouble with the Ubuntu LTS.
Now, looking at Brave, there's a 32-bit version for Windows, but no, you've got a package for Fedora/OpenSUSE and an RPM, and then you have a deb for Debian, Ubuntu, and Mint, and both 64-bit.
Well, I'm trying to retire my 32-bit machines from frontline service, which is why I want to drop a good burner into my new 64-bit system, desktop burner. Although running a burner remotely may mean that I'll have to learn some new applications.
And also WaterFox looks like only 64-bit for Linux. Well, only 64-bit all around, looks like.
Well, I've used it before on Windows, and the fact that it's up to Firefox 55 level without the commitment to only web extensions down the road is a very good thing.
Cool. You guys want to wrap it up?
You're the MC,
sir. I said it.
All right, then. Well, then I will go ahead and say our next recording date is September 15th, 2017. Our music is Downright, provided by Klaatu and Brome. We want to thank Tony Bemis from the Sunday Morning Linux Review for our web hosting WordPress support and our email listserv. We also want to thank Delwyn for providing the Mumble server we use and creating a bot module to find the next show recording date. All you have to do is type .ns in the IRC command line when you're in the Linux Logcast channel. And that's the end of the show. I'm Fweeb still, and 5150.
Just wanted to give a shout out to our listeners down in Texas. We're all thinking of you.
That's good. Yeah, true. And Honky Magoo?
Yeah, definitely thinking of you. Quick note, my printer's been running for a little while, and that the power brick is getting a little hot, so I might have to look into something over that. Anyways, good night, folks.
And Netminer.
Sorry, gents, I had to step away for a moment.
No worries. It was great to have you. See you guys in the next show.
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio-only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net /techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Blindridge, he's a bloody drunko.
If you don't like the gas, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies, that'll make it bad.
G'day, my name's Jude, or better known as Mrs. 64. Hacker Public Radio needs your help. They're running out of shows. If you ever thought you'd like to contribute or do a podcast yourself, here's your chance. Come on, Hacker Public Radio needs you. If you think you're going to sound silly or not going to sound like you know what you're doing, think again, because it never seems to stop my husband. It's easy, and if you live in the USA or the UK, it's as simple as picking up the telephone and phoning the call-in number to record a show, or plugging in a mic and opening Audacity. Get over to hackerpublicradio.org/contribute.php.